As our interest in formal planting and precisely manicured spaces has waned, gardens that let the wild in have become a prevailing current in contemporary garden design. The popularity of wildflowers and meadow-style matrices shows that the appetite to create spaces that feel closer to nature has bubbled way beyond a mere Instagram trend and deep into our horticultural psyche. But as two of our guests today are keen to point out, knapweeds and cornflowers aren't the only sources of inspiration for more naturalistic and wild vistas.
Much of Western North America is dominated by artemisia or sagebrush, and those simple kind of combinations of twisted wood bases arching and slithering through the landscape almost like an animal feeling very animated, and then mixed in with rabbit brush. I think for me at least, that was my gateway drug to shrubs, was just seeing that kind of beautiful combination, which is common, ubiquitous, but also for a reason. These are tough, adaptable plants, and I think we drew a lot of inspiration from their resiliency out in the wild.
Touch shrubs and cry.
Yeah. That's
the... Kevin Philip Williams and Michael Guidi will be presenting ideas from their new book, Shrouded in Light, Naturalistic Planting Inspired by Wild Shrubland. It's a beautiful manual for thinking differently. Jenny Lavell also returns this week with James Armitage to debunk more plant terminology. In Just Ask with Jenny Lavell, she covers the stuff that feels familiar but that we don't always 100% understand. So today we're talking about hybrids, what they are, how they occur, and how they can be used to your advantage. All of this to come in today's episode of Gardening with the RHS with me, Gareth Richards. But first, as Guy pointed out last week, it's high time to get going with your veg growing. We're gathering grow your own tips from around the RHS, and today we're heading to RHS Garden Rosemore to meet Peter Adams, leader of the edibles team there.
So my name's Peter Adams. I am the edibles and nursery team leader here at RHS Garden Rosemore. So if you can grow it and eat it at Rosemore, I oversee it. So that includes the fruit and veg garden, the orchards, the potager and the learning centre. And I also oversee the nursery, which produces about 95% of the plants that we use in the garden. So at Rosemore, we've got some really varied areas of edibles. The big key one as you come into the veg garden, we've got the orchards. So we've got the Southwest Orchard and the Devon Heritage Orchard. The Devon Heritage Orchard was set up in 2017 to preserve and save long lost heritage apples from Devon specifically. Some of these apple varieties are only known to be the last one or two trees known to actually still be in existence. So in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's going to be a full blossom show outside the veg garden. It's quite a spectacular seasonal event. As we come into the veg garden, we've got a fantastic fruit cage on the right-hand side. And one of the show-stopping parts here are the blueberries. They're currently flowering at the minute. Now, the blueberries, they're growing in an ericaceous bed. And they produce blueberries like I don't know what. And some of them are massive as well. It's a real striking thing when you come into the veg garden. As we move through, we've got the raised beds. Now, this is a particularly interesting area for me. It's an area we really maximise cropping from. We try and get some winter crops through there. But just as we're coming into spring now, we're starting to plant it with the first succession of crops. This is super early potatoes, varieties Rocket and Swift. Then we'll get some early spring lettuces in there. We've got shallots in there. And we've also got carrots and parsnips. And as the season progresses, this is a really fun part of the veg garden because it's free draining, raised, it's a bit warmer than most areas of the veg garden. And we can get away with growing some really tender crops in there, tomatoes, aubergines, sweet peppers. They do really well. And to see them growing outdoors in the UK and growing outdoors well is quite rare, really. As we move around, we've got the glasshouse, and this is reserved as a tomato and cucumber house during the summer months. And again, during the winter, we really try and make the most of those growing spaces, really trying to get all the winter crops, the winter greens, the mustard leaves, the oriental veg in there. And then the rest of the garden is laid over to traditional fruit and veg garden, so big beds, and we try and grow as many different varieties of as many different crops as we can. So if you're growing a bed of lettuce, then we'll have sort of 10 different varieties of lettuce in that bed. Same if it was a bed of Brussels sprouts or a bed of cabbages or something. The veg garden is also surrounded by two very thick south and west facing walls, which have got nectarines, peaches, apricots growing on them. Again, to see these growing outdoors successfully in the UK is rare. And one of the peach trees, I think we get about 40 plus peaches off each year. So that's really a sight to behold. The potager is a fantastic part of Rosemoor. It sits in the centre of the formal garden. And this is where the sort of art of fruit and veg growing really comes together. It's growing good, tasty food, but really celebrating the ornamental values of vegetable crops, whether that be textures and of foliage, whether that be different colours of different varieties, striking colours of chard really come into play in the potager. It really is an area to celebrate the differences of vegetables in the garden. And this year we are working on redesigning the planting of the potager. We're sticking with some traditional potager favourites, the broad bean crimson flowered and broad bean Sutton remain, but we're using them in a slightly different layout this year. We are also introducing some new varieties. We've got two big tall peas that we grow. One of the peas that we grow is purple podded, and we're introducing one called Lord Leicester. This is an old heritage variety. They're both tall growing peas. One is purple flowered, produces purple pods, whereas the Lord Leicester is a white flowered to contrast against the purple. We're introducing spinach varieties into the early planting of the potager. As we move into the season, we'll be bringing in the kales. The kales having wonderful different textures, different colours, different heights. A favourite is Buttonhole Star Maker. Buttonhole Star Maker has a real striking, deep cerise pink centre to the plant, really makes an ornamental value really stand out. And the potager will have a great display of edible flowers. The borage, nasturtiums really help set everything off. So this year it's going to be quite exciting, a whole sort of new planting in that area, just really reworking the old concept into something fresh and new. So this is a really busy time of year for us in the veg garden. It's really when the veg garden growing season kicks off. It's the time of sowing and planting. And I just wanted to share some of the little tips and tricks that we are doing this year to hopefully improve and have a fantastic growing season. One of the ones for us is we are trying a new technique for growing our parsnips. Our parsnips are growing in the raised bed, and parsnips are notoriously difficult to germinate. They're a thin, papery seed that dries out. And a little tip that we've picked up on this year and that we're trying is we are sowing our parsnips in drills as we would normally, a shallow drill. But this year we are trialing placing a plank across the top of the drill once we've sown them and backfilled. We're laying a plank over the top of the rows. And this plank's going to stay in place for 21 days exactly. This will help regulate the moisture levels, the temperatures, and after 21 days we'll remove that plank, and with a bit of good luck it will kickstart the parsnips into a fairly rapid germination. This is creating quite a lot of interest for our visitors in the garden at the minute, and we're really excited to see how this technique works for us. Something else that we're planting, we've just planted, are shallots. So shallots are really, I feel, a real sort of high value crop to grow. Not only are they not always the easiest vegetable to get hold of in the supermarket, but homegrown shallots, I think, have a real difference and depth of flavour. When we plant our shallots, we space them at about 9 inches between them in a row and between rows. So we keep them fairly tight. And with shallots, for every shallot set that you plant, in return, you're getting about 9 or 10 shallots. This is because the shallots divide as they grow and develop. And we plant them with a trowel, lowering them in just so the very papery tip of the shallot is just breaking the surface of the soil. The only problem with this is the birds do love to come along, and their inquisitive nature makes them wonder what this little straw-like top pointing out the soil is, and they'll quite happily pull on that straw top and flick the young shallot set onto the surface. So a little tip is to keep an eye on them, pop back, and you may find you have to plant them again a couple more times till the local bird population get bored and begin to leave them alone. And another one that we've just got in are our super early, first early potatoes. So a couple of varieties, Rocket and Swift. And again, these will produce an early crop ahead of your traditional first early potatoes. And we've got them in the raised bed. This not only will help bring them on a little bit quicker, it also allows us to place a cloche over the tops of the potatoes. So potato foliage is frost tender, and we're still likely to get one or two late frosts. And so it's really important to protect that foliage. So we'll earth them up as we go to try and protect them, but the cloche will also just give them that added bit of protection. So obviously, if you're at home and you haven't got a cloche to hand, very easy to sort of make out of any sort of clear plastic, polythene and some old water pipe, or some hoops made from some bamboo or some willow bent over. You can use corrugated plastic. As long as the light can penetrate through, then you can get creative, get imaginative with whatever you've got at home that you can make use of. So one last tip for you, whilst sowing peas, we find the local mice like to have a snack on any peas that we direct sow. And so a little top tip is to try sowing your peas in gutters, sowing them under glass in a greenhouse, on a bench just so they're out of reach, and growing them until they're about 2 inches above the surface and in a good peat-free potting compost. And when we're ready to plant them out and they're established, we pull out a drill, similar depth and dimensions to the gutter, and we give the gutters a good water, and then we encourage them to slide out the gutters into the drills. And that just gives them a bit of a head start against the mice. So it's a great time to get out in the veg garden, get some planting done. Hopefully the weather's going to start to improve, so enjoy a bit of sunshine when it comes. And if you want some inspiration, come and visit us at Rosemore and see what we're up to.
Thanks there to Peter. In my allotment this week, I had a lovely weekend actually in the sunshine, planting my Charlotte seed potatoes, which are a really, really tasty second early variety. I've been putting Bolt Hardy beetroot in. I know it's a bit of an old-fashioned variety, but it's still a really, really good one, especially if you live somewhere like I do, where you tend to have quite dry summers. And there could be a risk of bolting, which is when plants go to seed early. So you get a great big flower stalk and no beetroot, just a tiny little root. So yeah, I've been putting in my Bolt Hardy beetroot, my Charlotte seed potatoes, and I've been putting in sunflowers. So I did large modules because sunflowers are quite vigorous plants. They like to have a good amount of compost to get going. I put in Pro-Cut Plum and Claret, which are two modern sunflower varieties. Pro-Cut Plum has these gorgeous, dusky, peachy, pinky, sunset colour flowers. And then Claret has these amazing, deep, burgundy, burnt umber, reddish, lovely looking sunflower, just like a step up from your average yellow one. So they're good fun. And then also this year, I'm trying something called Tithonia, which is Mexican sunflower. I grew a couple last year and I was really mean to them. I took ages to plant them out. I planted them out really late. And they still got to about 5.5 feet tall and had these beautiful, like really searing orange flowers on them, and they kept going into November. And I thought, oh, if I'd just been a bit kinder to them, if I started them earlier and planted them out, they would have been amazing. So yeah, I'm giving Tithonia a try, and that's a half hardy annual, so it's good to start it undercover now. And the key with all of these things, if you're sowing stuff in your greenhouse, use peat-free compost. Obviously, we always say that, but also use fresh stuff. So if you've had seed compost from like a couple of years ago, don't bother sowing seeds in it because it may have picked up pathogens. It may not be in particularly good condition. So give your seeds the best start. And for the price of a bag of peat-free seed compost, it's well worth spending the money. And for those of us growing tomatoes, how many times have you noticed the phrase F1 hybrid on your seed packets? And is that the sort of thing you once looked up, but maybe you've forgotten precisely what it means? Jenny Lavell from the RHS online team is unafraid to admit that the science sometimes needs a bit of clarification. She's back with RHS botanist James Armitage to uncover what it all means for gardeners.
today, James and I wanted to look at a subject that comes up quite a lot on the podcast, and I think I have a base understanding of it, but I'd really like to know a bit more, and that is the subject of hybrids. So, James, what are hybrids?
Hybrids are the progeny of two different organisms, identifiably different things. So usually we talk about hybrids between different species, but it doesn't have to be. It could be hybrids between different cultivars or different genera even, but different living things producing progeny or offspring.
So it's another word for children?
Yes, but children between different things, so biologically identifiably different things.
Okay, I think I get that. So how do they occur?
They can occur in the wild. Cowslips and primroses will cross. Primula vulgaris and Primula veris will cross in the wild, hybridize in the wild, and produce some weird-looking children. But they also occur in plants more numerously in cultivation deliberately. So we deliberately try to cross two different things to get weird-looking offspring.
Why do we do it?
It enables us to introduce characters from one plant to another. So we might say, for instance, with roses are a really good example of hybridization, because you've got China roses, you've got roses from the Middle East, you've got European roses, and we've taken different characters from all those things. It might be the fragrance from one species, the size of the flowers, or the colour from other species, and we said we want to make a plant which has all of that stuff, and the way to do it is by hybridizing them.
It sounds like we're all like Frankenstein and playing God, but is there a benefit to the botanical world?
There's a benefit, certainly for gardeners, there's no question about that. So a lot of our most beloved garden plants are hybrids, and it's a benefit for agriculture as well. You can get plants with higher yields and better qualities, more disease resistance by crossing them together. So there's an undeniable, undoubted benefit to plants in cultivation. People, I think, when hybrids first started being produced for gardens, did feel a little squeamish about it and did think it was playing God to some extent, but we've got over that now, I fancy.
Which leads me to the next question. How do they occur? What happens?
Basically, you need to transfer the pollen, which contains the genetic material of one plant, onto the style, the receptive female part of another plant, and then you hope that magic happens. And that,
so romantic when you say it like that.
Isn't it? And that you get an embryo which contains the genetic material of both parents.
And if you're doing that yourself in your garden, how do you know that it's not, like, how do you know who the dad is? How do you keep it separate?
In plant breeding, they'll take time to emasculate the receptive flower so that it doesn't have its own pollen. Some plants can't pollinate themselves. Cerasus is the Judas tree, is an example that comes to mind. It's self-incompatible, so it won't fertilize itself. But most plants have the ability to fertilize themselves. So if you're a plant breeder, you take great lengths to ensure that the pollen that is received is the pollen you want it to receive.
And sometimes these hybrids, do they just happen?
They do, yeah. I mean, one of the really exciting things about gardens is they're like great big bubbling chemical experiments. You just put in all these ingredients and give them a bit of a swish round, and anything can happen. So in gardens, you get stuff which would never meet in nature. I was thinking things like Hamamelis is a good example. So you get Asian species and you get American species, and you don't get any European species. So they're separated by a big geographical range, but you put them in gardens and you get hybrids. And it's the same with Liriodendron. Liriodendrons you get in Asia and America, but you don't get in Europe. And so they're separated by hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary distance, but you put them back in gardens, you get hybrids. So anything can happen. And a lot of really fantastic garden plants have just been chance, just bees transferring pollen from one hopeful thing to another. And lo and behold, a little seedling. And you may not really know for certain what the parents are in those circumstances.
So I have an allotment. Mm-hmm. And when I get my seed catalogues out, there's always the options to buy these F1 seeds, and I've never really understood what they are.
An F1 hybrid is just the first generation from a particular cross. So when you buy F1 seed, that seed is a cross between two different parents. So if you were to grow seed from that cross, its children would be the F2 generation, but you wouldn't be very sure what you were going to get. There would be a lot more randomness, a lot more variation. But when you have these F1 hybrids, you reliably know what the progeny is going to be. So those seeds tend to be a little bit more expensive because you have to do this cross every time.
Right. So that you know what you're getting.
So that you combine the characters of these two parents. So it's a bit more a laborious process, but that's what an F1 seed is.
But that's why they're more expensive, because they're more reliable. But then if I grow my sweet corn from an F1 seed, it's going to be what it says on the packet.
That's right. And also it's likely to have quite a lot of vigour and quite a lot of what's often called hybrid vigour, where often they're very healthy plants, very robust. They can be quite a lot larger, perhaps more floriferous. And it's not really totally understood why this happens, but it's thought to be the opposite effect to inbreeding. So if you inbreed a lot, you tend to build up lots of deleterious or harmful kind of characters. We know this from royal bloodlines and things like that, where you get lots of inbreeding. It's not genetically healthy, and it's thought that hybrid vigour, you know, is somehow the opposite of this.
So what I get you saying is that in nature, plants have loads of different ways to pollinate each other. There's all these different methods. And it's fairly straightforward. It's fairly simple. And we as gardeners could do that ourselves quite simply. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it. You just want to get pollen from A to B. We can take the place of the wind or a butterfly or a hummingbird or whatever it happens to be, using a paintbrush and a bit of ingenuity. So gardeners at home can have a go at making their own hybrids. There's no guarantee, of course, that it's going to work. Even plants that look very similar, sometimes they just won't cross. And other plants that don't really look very similar sometimes will. But it's always worth having a go. And people trying hybrids at home have come up with some really wonderful garden plants over the years. So why not try? And it's very exciting seeing what you'll get.
And you make it sound like it's actually not that hard to do.
It's not that hard. I've done a bit of hybridizing with things myself. And it's an extremely exciting process because you feel like you're creating sort of new life. And even though I didn't come up with anything very fantastic, you still love these plants because they're yours, they're unique to use.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to give it a go. Yeah, I'm buying some paintbrushes this afternoon.
All right.
Thank you.
I do love Jenny and James as a combination. Jenny has such a great eye for like the questions we're all asking and kind of, well, actually, why? It's very easy in gardening to just take stuff for granted, and then you actually look behind it and go, well, why does that do that? And James just has such a deep level of knowledge, it's always fascinating to hear from him. For our final feature today, we're taking inspiration from some of nature's most abundant but overlooked spaces. Desert road cuts, abandoned pastures, heathland and marshy thickets form the basis for Kevin Phillip Williams and Michael Guidi's book, Shrouded in Light. Having formed a bond over design ideas at Denver Botanic Gardens, the pair join us today to explain why shrublands have become central to their design thinking.
So Michael and I both work at Denver Botanic Gardens, both in the horticulture department. And when we started, we both worked on a shift that was Tuesday through Saturday. We sort of were here for the emergency crew on weekends when most of the rest of the staff was gone. When we'd come in for lunch breaks, we'd sometimes eat lunch together, or sometimes we would just shout across cubicles because we were the only ones in the office about cool things that we were reading or listening to or seeing, and have these little meetings that was sort of the genesis of us really discussing our interests in music and art and philosophy and finding ways to meld them into our experiences in the Western United States. It turns out that we're both from upstate New York and had similar experiences moving out from an eastern temperate forest out to the dry steppe and arid shrublands that kind of exist out here, and really geeking out about like awesome hiking trails we had been on and just feeling like fresh eyes on a space.
One of the things we were noticing was that the vast shrublands of Western North America weren't just restricted to the arid steppe west of the Rockies, but they were also found up in these montane kind of intermountain parks up on the alpine tundra. seemingly everywhere. And at the same time, we also noticed that these kind of landscape templates weren't found in the gardens we were seeing anywhere. So part of what we were noticing was that shrublands kind of exist in all of these various ecosystems under just such a wide array of environmental conditions that maybe they do represent sort of an untapped reservoir for naturalistic garden design.
Coming from a land where almost everything is green all the time, the shock of seeing silver landscapes that just run on for millions of square miles, it's a culture shock.
Much of Western North America is dominated by artemisia or sagebrush. And those simple kind of combinations of twisted wood bases arching and slithering through the landscape, almost like an animal feeling very animated, and then mixed in with rabbit brush or Ericomeria nauseosa, that simple combination of just these two plants, I feel like, would always just melt our hearts. We're just like, this is just so beautiful on its own. And honestly, I think for me at least, that was my gateway drug to shrubs, was just seeing that kind of beautiful combination, which is common, ubiquitous, but also for a reason. These are tough, adaptable plants. And I think we drew a lot of inspiration from their resiliency out in the wild.
Yeah, touch shrubs and cry.
Yeah. That's that.
I had the privilege of traveling through Scotland last May. I think it was too early to catch the heath in bloom, but the gorse was going nuts and it was just ubiquitous, right? It was everywhere. It was incredible to see that. And I just had the privilege of traveling in Southern Africa in areas that we recognize as grasslands, but I would say that they were at least 50% shrublands also, with these really complex shrub communities. Even steppe grassland or montane grassland were mostly dominated by these shrubs. And so sometimes I wonder if people just haven't been cued into seeing it yet.
In the book, we're talking about new garden design templates, but with these templates from shrublands around the world come new ecological interactions and new ways that plants are interacting with each other that we can bring into the garden spaces. So one of the interesting ecological phenomena we talk about in the book is the nurse plant effect. So in dry, arid regions around the world, many forbs and succulents won't germinate out in the open sunlight on an exposed gravel or soil bed, and often need the shelter of a larger woody form in order to germinate, grow, and develop. So that's one way that we've thought about shrubs as caretakers. So dampening, mitigating environmental conditions in this way that allows for the interactions of plants in their kind of space, in their shadow, in the zone of their hydraulic lift for water to behave a little bit differently. And also this heterogeneity in the landscape too provides some degree of resilience, I think, that might not be there in a more homogenized landscape with a single growth form like grasses and forbs, like a meadow kind of matrix. We're adding kind of another dimension to gardens by adding those persistent woody forms. And if there are any laws in ecology, one of them that tends to hold true is that the greater the structural complexity of vegetation, the more biodiversity that space will house. So I think the first step would be to encourage people to get outside and get into a natural space near where they live. And we can almost guarantee that they will find some intermediate woody growth forms, aka shrubs, and we'll be able to draw some inspiration for them.
In the book, we have little pieces that we call extracts, where we will sort of use a Keith Haring-esque outlines over the major components of the ecosystem. And usually we found that those break down into three or four major parts. So I think that if you find shrubland that you think is particularly inspiring and want to begin translating into a home garden, start by looking at the major components. And usually you'll find that there's probably anywhere between one to four dominant species that you can really start focusing in on and spending the majority of your resources sort of acquiring and even directly aping that layout, adjusted slightly for your own. But the magic of shrublands isn't just in the shrubs, right? As we talked about, it's part of the fact that they're caretakers and they're part of these mixed complex communities. So making sure to lay out the shrubs in a way that has some sort of dynamic flow to it, but then looking at all of those interstitial spaces and filling them with bulbs and grasses and wildflowers, forbs, herbaceous bits, determining the scale that you want. Are the shrubs going to be the much smaller, tighter, almost negative space element in that, or are they going to be the very vivacious, charismatic element that sort of comes out above everything else? And then making sure that you're incorporating a lot of different planting schemes into one space, right? Overlaying a lot of plants with different plans on top of each other. So we really like to seed in between our plantings, be creating very competitive or very stressful situations for those, and allowing yourself to really be surprised by it, right? We want things that have growth on different time scales. We want things that have different flowering periods. We want things that have different heights, different death rates, all part of that bigger scheme to not control a space, right? To let things truly interlace and interface with each other and not try to create this binding structure that only acts in one way. And I think that we've tried to offer a few strategies in the book that will help you approach that faster than just creating that initial sort of matrix planting.
Yeah. On a very literal note, a matrix can really be a grid, a two-dimensional kind of thing that interacts at perpendicular angles. When we think of mesh, I think we're thinking of things sticking out and coming at you, moving away from you at sort of these oblique angles. And we mean that sort of literally because shrubs are adding this additional structural element, but it also happens on temporal scales. So shrubs will change the space around them, and therefore the interstitial plants that share that space will behave in a different way. The thing about mesh is it's tangled. It's hard to get undone. It's not as though you're just slipping perpendicular threads across from each other. So I think that speaks to like the more tightly knit plant community dynamics that I think we're trying to get at in the book with mesh, not matrix.
A mesh is hard to untangle. And I think if we're really advocating gardens for change, gardens for the future, gardens for this weird climate, we need to make things that are hard to untangle, right? These really complex, weird spaces that can persist and have the capacity to sort of move beyond this. So maybe that's just something that we're trying to offer, is another way to look at these plantings away from the matrix.
Kevin and Michael's book, Shrouded in Light, is out now, and it's a really beautiful tome to leaf through. Across the pages, they pair amazing photos of the landscapes they're describing with explanations of how the plants interact and some abstract art pieces that reflect their colours, shapes and textures. It's a really ingenious shorthand to describe just how beautiful these natural forms and these natural combinations are, and then place them side by side in exhibition. It's a visual feast. Kevin and Michael use the word mesh to describe their method of planting, moving past what we might know as matrix planting to allow more plants to fill the spaces and interact with each other. I really like this idea of a mesh being much more of a 3D look at plants and planting. You know, plants coming at you from all these different angles, filling in every single space, seeding into the gaps, becoming something that's, as they say, like hard to untangle. And they have this kind of inbuilt diversity and joinedness, for want of a better word, which, you know, if it's hard to untangle, then maybe that's more resilient in the face of climate change and other pressures that we put on the natural world. I think it's interesting that in Britain, we've used to have shrubberies, and shrubberies were a really big thing. And then we've had this fashion for new perennials has come in. And then we're starting to see more shrubs coming in now, but I think quite often they're limited to winter gardens. You know, you think of the coppicing that we do of things like Cornus annis winter orange or Sanguinea midwinter fire, all of those kind of things. We're sort of mimicking these processes that maintain a natural shrubland, but we've kind of confined it to winter gardens. Why not have it all year round? I mean, one place you can see a good shrubland, it's an extreme example of it, is the heather landscape at Wisley. They have some really beautiful heathers that flower any time of the year, and then they mix it with other shrubs as well. And it's really, really clever, really interesting, and well worth a visit. That's almost it for this episode. But before we go, I wanted to share a few things that I've been up to in the garden this week. So obviously, as I talked about, lots of veg planting. Now is the time to get your veg in. I'm also starting to look at my houseplants and they're really starting to grow again. So now's a good time to think about repotting your houseplants. So don't put them into an enormous pot, put them into a pot 2.5 centimeters bigger either side, something like that, depending on the size of the plant, but just sort of the next size pot up is really good. And you can buy specialist peat-free houseplant compost or peat-free multi-purpose will be okay too. I'm also looking after my bulbs. Now, we've had a lot of queries on the RHS website, and the RHS online advice team have been dealing with this. A lot of people have daffodil blindness. So if your daffodils haven't flowered, one thing to do is make sure that they're not planted too shallowly. So if you only planted them last year, dig them up. They want to be at least twice their own depth into the soil. Look out for distortion too. So if they have streaked yellowish leaves, they could well have viruses or other pathogens. To be honest, they're not that expensive. It's much better to throw those away and replant in the autumn. And also give them a feed as well. So if they're in pots, give them a high potash liquid feed, something like tomato food. It's really, really good. If they're in the ground, a good sprinkling of general purpose fertilizer will help give them a bit of oomph, put some energy back into the bulbs, and hopefully you'll get flowers coming through next year. It's also time to sow hardy annuals such as poppies, field poppies, Papaveroeus, Nigella, which is love in a mist. Really, really easy. Prepare your soil to a fine tilth and then rake it, throw the seeds on, rake it again, and you'll have brilliant displays of beautiful flowers for not much money and not much effort. But remember also, we want to hear from you, so do send us your gardening queries to podcasts@rhs.org.uk. That's podcasts@rhs.org.uk. That's all for now, so thanks for listening, and until next time, from me, Gareth Richards, happy gardening!